You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
Given the collapse of major multilateral agreements like the WTO, one might be forgiven for thinking that the era of neoliberal trade agreements has passed. That's not the case. Spurred on by corporate interests and the need for profit and control, bilateral, that is, country-to-country, trade and investment agreements have very quietly taken the world by storm. They've received very little attention compared to their multilateral counterparts. To discuss their proliferation, we've reached journalist and activist Stéphane Christophe in Montreal. Good morning, Stéphane.
Hey, good morning. Nice to speak with you.
Can you give us a sense of the degree to which these types of bilateral agreements are proliferating?
Well, really, in fact, it's quite incredible. Literally, there's a tapestry of agreements across the world, and Canada is playing a quite active role in pursuing these bilateral negotiations. As you mentioned in the introduction, of course, a lot of the push towards bilateral country-to-country agreements or even regional trade accords came after the collapse of the World Trade Organization, the WTO's international ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico. And since that time, we've really seen a push, particularly from major economic players in the world, in the Western countries, really, in Canada, the United States, Western Europe, to secure bilateral agreements. So, for example, Canada at this moment is negotiating agreements across the world, whether it's the controversial accord with Colombia that has gotten some play, to more obscure agreements with countries like Bahrain in the Middle East or Morocco, which are currently pending, and as far-flung as a country like Mongolia, where Canada is actually involved in bilateral negotiations. So really, we can talk about the specificities of these particular agreements, but I think in the case of Canada or the United States, the central theme is that, unlike the World Trade Organization, where, you know, with all the critiques that one could have towards that institution, the fact is that in the bilateral context, there is a much more unequal relationship. So if Canada, say, or the United States is negotiating an agreement with a smaller country in Central America or Latin America, the balance of power is unequal, and it's much more easy to secure details or secure legislation that is more beneficial both to Canadian economic interests or business.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. The Canadian government recently revamped its foreign aid policies, and it appears now that aid is being used to get countries to sign free trade agreements. Can you talk about that?
Well, this is a parallel that I drew in an article that I wrote. It's been talked about, but not that widely, and I think it's a very important point. And so I guess very quickly, what you could say is that Canada, under Liberal governments, had a quite far-reaching aid policy. We can have our critique on that, but under the Conservative government, Canada has a new policy, which is called countries of concentration, which limits aid to 20 countries around the world. And it focuses particularly on Latin America and the Caribbean, while Canadian aid to African countries like Kenya, Cameroon, and Rwanda has actually been cut. And this is a policy change that's happened without any public debate, once again, right? This is actually a major shift in Canadian foreign policy, but there's been no sort of public discussion. And I think the media has really failed to address the seriousness of both Canada's shift in terms of aid policy and its shift in terms of trade policy around the world. So in terms of the countries of concentration aid policy, it's really quite striking. If you line up the 20 countries that Canada has quote-unquote chosen for its aid focus, those are the same countries that Canada is currently focusing on securing bilateral agreements with. So one could ask the question, why are we donating aid, this is usually through the Canadian International Development Agency, CETA, only to countries that agree to sign a free trade accord with us? I mean, aid is supposed to be non-committal. That's the entire premise of aid. We can still have our critiques about aid, but the point is here is that aid and trade are so deeply interlinked. And I think it's part of the conservative government's ideology, which is that Canada will only interact with the world on the basis of its own benefit, without any notions of solidarity or global consciousness, but really rooted in an attempt to secure funds for Canada's business sector.
One of your concerns is how these agreements are used to push non-trade-related political objectives. Mm-hmm. Can you explain this, maybe, for instance, using the Middle East as an example?
Well, this is really important, and I think it illustrates how trade is actually, you know, whether it's we have these bilateral agreements that are tied to foreign aid, but in the case of the Middle East, it's just simply quite striking. Just to be very specific, if you look at the text of the agreements, both that Canada is pushing and the United States with countries across the Middle East, they, within the text of the agreements, have a call for a normalization of relations with Israel within the text of the agreement. So, specifically speaking, as probably some of your listeners know, there's you know, for decades and decades, there's been an official boycott from the Arab League towards the government of Israel. The U.S. for years and years and years has been trying to break that boycott, but essentially through these trade accords, and Canada's right behind U.S. policy on this one, is basically pushing forward normalization with Israel. But it's actually within the text of these trade agreements. So the governments that are being partnered in these bilateral relations, whether it's Bahrain or Morocco or the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Egypt do have diplomatic relations with Israel, so they were some of the first countries to sign agreements with both with the United States, bilateral accords, that is. But in all these other agreements, you're having a demand within trade legislation to normalize relations with Israel. So at this point, maybe it sounds normal, normalizing relations with Israel, but across the Middle East and increasingly on an international level, Israel is viewed and understood as a country that one should not engage with diplomatic relations with until its occupation of the Palestinian territory ceases. So this is just another facet, I think, of the conservative government's overt and direct support for Israeli military policy in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
And is there a kind of counterpart legislation in the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's Canada's first agreement signed outside of North America was with Israel, and that was January 1st, 1997. And it's a really important agreement, I guess one of the important clauses to that agreement, and with also the concurring agreements that Quebec has signed, unfortunately, and also Ontario has signed as a province with Israel. Partner. These are not bilateral trade accords, but more economic partnership agreements. But in all these agreements, the important point here in Canada is that the agreements do not distinguish the difference between a product made inside of Israel, so let's say the internationally recognized borders of the Israeli state, and a product produced in a settlement. So this is a really important point because essentially this is a breach of international law that Canada is agreeing to within a trade accord. Because if you're accepting that a product produced by Israeli companies in an Israeli settlement or essentially colony in the West Bank, it means that you're politically legitimizing that settlement, which under the Geneva Accord, you know, of course, you can't transfer your own population to a land that you're occupying. So in the case of Israel, is legally barred in international law from transferring its population into the occupied territories. But Canada, in fact, through this trade legislation, is recognizing Israel's legitimate presence in the West Bank, which even Barack Obama has called for an end to.
Now, in many countries, there have been major resistance movements to these type of bilateral agreements. Can you give us a sense of what some of these movements are looking like?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's really interesting, and it's quite global. You know, for example, the trade accord between the U.S. and South Korea, for example, I mean, we can really jump all over the world, and that's what's I said earlier about these trade accords. It's so important to understand that this is really a global phenomenon. Now, there's a lot of opposition in Asia to these agreements that are being pursued by the United States. And just very quickly, in the case of Korea, social movements in the country have been opposing very rigorously since the mid-1990s Korea's participation in the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and that actually led to a very historic moment and a tragic one in 2003 in Cancun, Mexico, and that's when a Korean farmer took his own life in protest of the World Trade Organization. And the protest was essentially about the fact that under WTO legislation, World Trade Organization legislation, that Korean farmers were losing their livelihood because the country was being open to foreign exports that were coming into Korea at such a low price that local producers could not survive. But the thing is what with bilateral accords is that the legislation that we saw, you know, for example, in the World Trade Organization, that was so drastic that even led a Korean farmer to take his life in Cancun in 2003, which was a huge moment internationally. The legislation on bilateral front is even worse. And so, for example, there's been huge protests in Korea against the U.S. Korea deal, and it led to a situation essentially where the Korean parliament had to be surrounded by giant shipping containers because there was such huge protests for weeks on end, and it ended up in a situation where the National Assembly was in a lockdown basically for quite a few weeks. That was only this year. And scuffles, physical fights broke out in the Korean National Assembly over this bilateral accord. And it's really, if you read media from Asia, you can see what a big deal this is in terms of the level of public and social economic debates about these trade accords. But here we're seeing nothing. We're seeing no real discussion about these bilateral agreements, which is really striking. Where in the global south, even the mainstream media in countries like South Korea that we're talking about was involved in a discussion on these issues. And just very quickly, the reason that the protests became so huge and popular in Korea was that there was legislation in the country to ban U.S. beef imports that were coming into the country, displacing local beef production. But at the same time, they were banned because mad cow disease had been discovered in beef imports from the United States. So the Koreans essentially rejected the idea that they had to import U.S. beef into the country, given the disease that they had, their medical officials had concluded was being caused by U.S. beef. But despite that, the bilateral agreement necessitated Korea to import U.S. beef.
I am going to have to jump in there and wind it up, but yeah. I really appreciate your joining us, and we'll point people to your website, Stefan.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with journalist Stefan Christoff. He's helped produce an information site on bilateral trade. It's called fightingftas.org, which you can visit to find out more about this topic.